Hey everyone, Alex here. In this episode of Terror Talk, I sat down with Blake Best. Blake is an accomplished musician, actor, and author who has traveled across the country, whether it performing music or attending horror conventions and meeting fans. He was introduced in the Hall of Horror in Las Vegas in 2016. He was presented with a plaque for notable contributions to horror. In our interview, we discuss all things horror movies and talk all about Blake's projects and accomplishments. Without further ado, let's jump into the interview. Once again, thank you for spending some time with me today. If you first actually wanted to introduce yourself for those who don't know you.
Okay, sure. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. my name is Blake Best. I am an award-winning author, an actor, a composer, a producer, a podcaster, a session guitar player. There's so much more, but that's the crux of everything right there in one neat little package.
Yeah. After you kept sending like all the things you did, I'm like, wow, he really does absolutely anything and everything. So I wanted to make sure that you got to say all the various things you do. It's really impressive.
I appreciate that. It's a lot of work. It's not all fun and games, let me tell you.
Oh yeah, I could only imagine, especially like just myself working on a podcast. Like, even though it's just a hobby for me, it's like just working on that is a lot of work. I can only imagine all the work you put into everything.
I have a lot of respect and appreciation for podcasts, you know, because it's not something for everyone. It's really not. I mean, people try, and I mean, I've done several hundred episodes of shows, and it's fun, but it takes a certain kind of team to make it work. And you've also got to account for all the various things that go wrong, technology, signal dropping. In this day and age, everything's supposed to be so technologically advanced, but if it's going to falter on you, it's going to pick the most inconvenient and inopportune moment to do so.
I know, technology. I also stream. I didn't mention I stream on Twitch, and it's a running joke within my community that it's not one of my streams unless there's a technological issue. So I definitely understand.
That keeps it based in reality. It makes everything, you know, it's like life. It doesn't exactly always run smoothly. That's perfect. You
know? For sure. It's like 20 minutes of me trying to fix everything before I even get started. So yeah, technology is always so fun to deal with. But for my first question, I just was curious how you got into horror movies to begin with.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, it sort of happened by accident. Growing up, things at home were a little rough for me, and kind of, you know, with everything going on, there's just lots of issues. I won't go into a whole lot. I mean, I know there's a bio out there that people have seen of it, but I come from an abusive home, lots of physical and emotional abuse, and probably one of the best ways I could figure to escape that was to turn on the television or listen to music and kind of lose myself in whatever it was I was involved with. So I discovered horror kind of on accident. I am old enough to have owned cassette tapes. And one of the first cassette tapes I owned was Vincent Price reading The Telltale Heart and The Gull Bug. And I fell in love with audiobooks and the narration. And Vincent Price, I'm sure you know who he was, but he had a very creepy voice and inflection. And whenever he read something, you kind of wanted to stop what you were doing and sort of focus 100% on him. And that was the first thing that got me exposed to like horror as far as a medium outside of movies. Now, first movie I ever saw, I was about 6 years old, and I snuck, you know, the TV on late at night, Cinemax, and it was the first one I ever saw actually was A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2. And okay. When I turned it on, the very first thing I saw was the sequence when Mark Patton's character Jesse Walsh is on the bus, and they're driving out really erratically into the desert, and then the bus driver starts to turn into Freddy. And then, you know, people start screaming on the bus, the other girls that are with him, and the ground kind of gives way, and there's this red thing. It almost, for lack of a better word, looks like the underworld being exposed. Mm-hmm. And it was just creepy and terrifying. And when Freddy stepped out of the shadows through that smoky fog, and you heard those finger blades kind of clicking together, that sort of meant, oh, wow, this is about to pick up in a whole nother kind of way here. So I kind of was fascinated with that. And Nightmare on Elm Street was probably the first franchise that I ever really fell in love with. That I watched every single entry in order after that night. I made it a point in my life to watch every single every single entry. Probably the weirdest one was pay-per-view was still a thing, and Freddy's Dead came out, and I rented it off of pay-per-view. I was about seven, I guess, six and a half, 7 years old, and I saw it, and the bus sequence of him hitting the boy, no screaming while the bus is in motion, you know, this whole, it was ridiculous, but I loved it, and so I sort of watched all those, and that's what got me started in horror was Nightmare on Elm Street, certainly.
Now, I don't want to assume Nightmare on Elm Street is your favorite scary movie, but I'm going to ask, what's your favorite scary movie?
You know, in a different time and place, if you had a voice changer and a cordless phone, that question will be a lot scarier. Right?
I know. Maybe in like After Effects, I'll change my voice. But
there you go. Hey, that could be fun. Probably my favorite scary movie of all time would be the original Nightmare on Elm Street, because I saw it later. I didn't see it first. That was probably that definitely in the top three. I think right behind that would probably be Friday the 13th Part 2.
Okay.
Seeing the vantage point of Alice's house from what looks like some sort of intruder outside, and then her opening the door and seeing Mrs. Voorhees' head in the fridge, and then the ice pick through the temple, was terrifying. The poor cat. The poor cat saw everything. The cat needed therapy.
Oh, for sure.
But that one would be right behind that. And then I think probably third would probably be Scream. The first Scream, that whole what's your favorite scary movie with the phone ringing. It's like every Friday night for us growing up ever. You talk on the phone with your pals and you're getting ready to watch a movie, you know, hey, come over, let's get pizza or do whatever. And that was just normal. That felt real, you know, definitely.
Yeah. I will admit, I don't know a whole ton about A Nightmare on Elm Street. I enjoy it, but I'm definitely a huge Scream fan. So I definitely can relate to Scream.
Right on. Absolutely. And it was one of those that really, they took a chance on it because it was released December the 20th, 1996. So it was, you know, right close to Christmas. They took a real chance with that. And I think that's part of what made it so successful is not oftentimes are there a lot of horror films that come out around holidays like Christmas because, you know, the thematic content, but they definitely hit a home run with that one. So.
Oh yeah, for sure. I didn't realize it came out in the winter. You'd think it'd be like a really good summer movie.
You would think so, but then you'd also think that Die Hard wouldn't technically be considered a Christmas movie, but it is. The first one anyway.
The great debate is Die Hard a Christmas movie? I say a lot of people say yes more often than not.
I'll say yippee-ki-yay. How about that?
There we go. So, the answer might not be your favorite scary movie, but what do you consider some of the scariest movies you've ever seen?
That is a really good question. You come fully prepared tonight. I appreciate that. I like it.
Good.
probably one of the scariest that I think I ever saw was, it came down to two, but I think certainly Last House on the Left, I Spit on Your Grave, those two.
Okay.
Back to back, because it just, that kind of stuff, it feels like it's horror based in reality. I mean, how many people go and want to go to a rock concert or a music concert or whatever and hitchhike with, you know, to get a ride from someone and it turns out they're a complete psychopath.
Right.
and probably in my top four, and I'm sure I'll get a little flack for this. One of my friends is John Dugan, who played Grandpa in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original.
Oh, really?
And that one is certainly one of the scariest I've ever seen. And he had so many cool stories about the making of that. And he was so young. I mean, that old age makeup, it was so extensive that once he was in it to finish the scenes, and then everything else would come later. He wanted to get in and out of that as best he could.
Oh, I'm sure.
Ridiculous. I mean, he was in his early 20s when he did that, you know?
Oh, really? Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, definitely Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original. Anything that's kind of rooted in reality, which is odd because Nightmare on Elm Street is certainly not rooted really in reality and in certain aspects, but Texas Chainsaw, I mean, this is like stuff you could hear about on the news, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a funny story about the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So I had seen like the remake, a lot of the sequels, and I think it was in high school at the time. My sister's a huge horror fan too. We rented the original because we'd never seen it, and we got Chipotle. And we decided to eat Chipotle while we watched this movie, and both of us got so sick halfway through. I was like, I can't even watch this movie and eat. I got so nauseous. So
was it the movie that made you nauseous, or was it the food that made you nauseous? I'm curious.
I'm willing to bet it was the movie, only because okay. I've never had that issue before. The original Texas Chainsaw was so disturbing to me, like especially the scene with the hammer. Like, I think that was about the point where I started like not feeling so great. I was like, oh no, like I can't.
Oh, John,
I can't do
John
this.
Would be thrilled. He at the last convention I had, I actually prop hammer and he signed it for me, and he when I took a photo, he took it and raised it over my head as if he was going to strike me with it, and
oh
that
my
was
gosh.
The funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I mean it's a great scene, but it's also so disturbing. I was like, gotta take a break from this. Curious, what are some of your favorite but also some of your least favorite aspects of the horror genre, if you have any least favorites, that is?
So certainly some of my favorite aspects are, I like originality. You know, I really like something that hasn't been done before. Before Nightmare on Elm Street, nothing like that had been done before. Scream, nothing like that had been done before. Psycho, nothing had really been done like that before. I like originality. And then that's definitely important, because if it's something original, people are going to be more apt to sit and kind of focus on it, pay attention. If it's something that feels like it's contrived or something that they've seen before, even if it's not the case, if they get that vibe from it, then sometimes they won't give it as much of their undivided attention. And I really think that horror films deserve undivided attention. That is a treat. I mean, I watch at least, you know, probably half a dozen every week while I'm, you know, composing or doing whatever. That's like the soundtrack to my day is, you know, a horror film in the morning, afternoon, or evening. It doesn't really matter. And, you know, I sometimes I eat when I watch them. Sometimes I don't, whatever. I mean, it just, that's a day. So I like originality. My least favorite aspect about it is I feel like sometimes there's a focus on certain aspects of the genre, maybe specifically slashers, which there's nothing wrong with slashers. They're my favorite, but I sometimes feel like there's a more of an emphasis on the sexual aspects, the nudity. And I don't always feel like that that's necessary. You know, it's fine. I mean, if it calls for that, but a movie can be scary without those things. As I said, Psycho had very limited, I mean, Janet Leigh was in the shower and you saw from here up and then her legs and then the shower thing. And, you know,
yeah.
You see with Jaws, even you see the girl go swimming in the original, Susan Backlini, her character, she goes swimming and there's a little bit of nudity, but it's kind of artfully executed. So I really feel like there's certain things that don't have to be done. And I enjoy gore. I really do. But I really think that a good story works really well with gore. It doesn't have to be gore for gore's sake. And that's no disrespect to any film that's a gore film. That's what their basis is, because I appreciate those too. But I like a really strong story to go along with my gore, because sometimes it's the stark contrast between this story that you get lost in, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, here comes this gory, unexpected scene, and you're like, "Whoa, that was not something that I expected." But it leaves like this indelible mark in your head, like. You get this visual and mental image of this movie. And from then on, when you think of that film, you'll think of the story, but you'll also think of that scene that just shocked you to no end, you know? And I think that that's something that a lot of horror films take care of quite well. I mean, definitely the story mixed with the gore and like with Scream, like we just talked about, there's a story there, you know, the backstory of the you know, the lead characters and everything, and then there's this other story with the killers and so on and so forth, but you get vested in it, and I think that's important, because I feel like a horror film should be just as important and just as focused on as, say, a drama film or a romance film, you know?
Yeah, I agree, because one of my biggest things is just like shock for shock's sake. That doesn't really apply to the story at hand. Like, if you're just trying to put gore or nudity just to shock me, then I don't really care all that much. But if it's there for a purpose or a reason to connect to the story, like, that's when I'm like okay with it.
Well, and you said it yourself. I mean, if they just focus on gratuitous nudity or whatever it is, you don't really pay attention to it. So in them trying to shock you, what it has essentially done is desensitized you to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you're not studying. Now, if they give you a story and then all of a sudden there's the axe to the face and you see entrails after you found out this heart-wrenching, amazing story, then it's totally different kind of feel, you know? Mm-hmm. And I really felt like there's a film that I saw recently that's become one of my new favorites. Thanksgiving.
Oh, you saw that?
Eli Roth. Yes, I did.
I haven't seen it yet.
Talking about that is I won't ruin it for you, but there is a story there, and there are kills there that are quite inventive and quite gory.
Okay.
Prepare yourself, but the story is worth it. Absolutely.
Okay, I'll have to check it out. Yeah, I've been meaning to see that, and I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. So for my next question, kind of similar, but what are some of your favorite like subgenres or tropes in horror?
That's a really, really good question. Like I said, you come fully prepared. If this was a Die Hard film, I'd be in trouble. You know, that's really good questions. And you know, thinking about it, some of the things, there's so many. I really like we said, a good story. I like it when the character that you wouldn't think would survive does.
Mm-hmm.
I like when it kind of turns the trope on its ear, for lack of a better word. Night of the Demons is a perfect example of that. That's a film from 1988. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend it. It's a sort of almost like a subgenre. It's a slasher slash kind of possession-y kind of, mm-hmm. you know, story. But the two characters survive that you wouldn't expect to survive it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that just, to me, that I didn't see it coming, and I haven't seen it quite executed like that since. So mm-hmm. that's why it sticks with me. So I like when they take things and they turn it on its ear, or sometimes I really, really like the red herring.
Yeah.
You know, we see that executed quite well in Scream, in all of them. You know, there's a red herring, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, who do you think? And sometimes it's something as simple as the way a camera angle is executed. Like in the original Scream, there's a cut to Sheriff Burke's boots, which are the same boots that are worn by the killer. So you're like, well, that's really odd that they had decided to focus on that specific shot of those boots.
Mm-hmm.
Or the fact that, you know, the deputy conveniently has a cell phone, you know, at a moment when he probably shouldn't have it.
Right.
You know, so you know, certain things like that are put into place that I think are done, you know, intentionally. So another one of my favorite subgenres, I really like possession stuff to a degree. And then some of the found footage stuff. I mean, I was, you know, I grew up in the age of The Evil Dead, Army of Darkness,
mm-hmm.
The Blair Witch Project, Quarantine, you know, all those films like that. And there's certainly a found footage aspect to the way some of the original Friday the 13th are shot. That shaky kind of camera angle that's all over the place.
You know? Yeah, I could definitely see that. Well, I kind of want to start digging into all the different projects you do. So the first one I kind of wanted to talk about is your writing.
Okay.
I was a little curious how you even got into writing.
I got into it at a young age. I was about 9 years old. I entered a contest. I was writing like a little informal essay at school. I was, you know, fourth grade. And it was on a subject that I actually ended up studying later on and became a sort of a scholar in that area. It's called cryptozoology. So that's the study of animals that are purported to exist that may not, i.e. mm-hmm. Bigfoot, Jersey Devil, so on and so forth. So my essay was on the Loch Ness Monster, which is a cryptid that I've written books on, several of them. So I did an essay to kind of inform someone who may not have a working knowledge of Loch Ness and the history of its mysterious denizen, you know, of the deep there,
mm-hmm.
And sort of the stories about how the sightings got started and, you know, some of the backstory of the lake itself, the geographical points, how it was created, you know, 10,000 years after the last ice age, and sort of how it got carved out of and became landlocked. So it and over time gradually became desalinated and became a freshwater lake. So I kind of just, it was sort of an all around informal thing, and I ended up winning some money and won like a little award, a little scholarship off of that.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
I was like, okay, cool. You know, so that sort of started my interest in writing. And then, of course, a different kind of writing. But when I became a professional musician, I was always in charge of writing music and sometimes lyrics for certain things too. So that sort of expanded out into book form. So the first book that I actually wrote was one that took me years to do. So Fathom was about the Loch Ness Monster. I started that one, and it took me about 5 years to complete that. I had other things come up, other book opportunities, acting opportunities, and other things, composing. So that kind of they all took a front seat to that, and it took the back seat. Well, I decided to pick back up with that, and put that out. So that was the first book that I really put out that was a full-fledged novel. Now I do specialize in novels. I have co-written one nonfiction book, but mostly what I focus on are fiction. I like fiction, specifically horror. So the next book I worked on was called The Within, which was a possession tale, sort of set in Southern California, more modern day. There's laptops, cell phones. It's not like a period piece. It's set in modern time. And I released that book to pretty wild acclaim. I didn't realize it was going to be as big of a deal as it was. While I was busy kind of touring on that one, and doing conventions and signings, I decided to write a book called Razor's Edge, which is my interpretation of the origin story for Freddy Krueger, the character from Nightmare on Elm Street. So this delves into his backstory from a very young age up through his eventual spoiler. If you're not aware, audience, Freddy doesn't make it out unscathed. He gets killed by the vengeful parents of Springwood, which is the town in which they live, where he has killed 20 children. So he ends up getting out of that trouble on a technicality, and the parents get angry and they take the law into their own hands. Well, it doesn't come without consequences. They essentially became the same thing he was, but in a different scope. They were murderers as well. They took a man's life and they shouldn't have. And I think that exploring that sets the stage for what he's able to do later. Because if you've seen the films, you don't ever see him alive. He's already deceased by that point. He's a dream demon. He's already dead. So the book focuses on his actual life while he was alive, and the creation of his famous glove, and all of the victims. It's the first time in print that the 20 original victims were ever detailed, named, aged, and manner of death. First
Oh,
time
wow.
that had ever happened. So it became a blockbuster, like fans all over. I can never keep copies of that book in stock. So I was like, whoa. So and I didn't realize that that book would make The Within, which was the possession book, so much harder to find. So I came up on a convention where a fan approached me and said, hey, I really want to get a copy of The Within. Do you have the original pressing of the book with a different cover? I said, I do not. I'm sorry, I don't have one. He said, well, I found one online, but I can't believe that it cost as much as it does. And I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, when I put the books out, they were 15, 16 books, $16 a piece with shipping. So 20, and then I'll sign it for you. So it was like $20. Okay. He shows me the picture of it on Amazon, and the seller had it listed for $2,013.80.
2000.
I said,
Wow.
okay, well, I said, if you get a copy of that book, hang on to it, because if I sign it, that'll probably add, $100 more to the value. So hold on
Oh,
to it.
more
Maybe I
than
could just
that.
trade it in for a used car. Trade it in for a
Yeah.
used car, or
A down
something like
payment.
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, or put it down on that engagement ring I know you're thinking about buying, do
Yeah.
something with that like that. So it was wild.
That's crazy.
And I didn't realize the impact it was going to have. And then I was doing a, I've been doing signings all these years, and it's wild. The last convention I did, I had a gentleman actually drive from Atlanta to Knoxville to see me,
Really?
which is not a short drive.
No. No.
And he bought one of every one of my books. And then I actually, just to do a fun thing, I had a prototype glove built for me by another builder that was signed by the mayor of Knoxville, who was the wrestler Kane, Glenn
Okay.
Jacobs. So it was signed. He said, if you decide that you want to, I'll give you money for it. I want you to go through the haunt with me. I want to enter into the contest where it's, like you go through with a celebrity through this thing. Because the event that I did was at a haunt I said, sure. So they bought the book and they bought the books, the glove, they bought everything I had, posters. I mean, the gentleman left with everything I had, one of everything at least. And I was, so I said, sure, let's do the haunt, you know, and I had a good time doing that. But, it's wild. When I did my very first signing in Las Vegas, there was a lady that came to see me, actually. She was like somebody's grandmom. I mean, and she was buying books for her grandkids, mm-hmm. you know, Christmas birthday present. She drove 2 hours.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. To see me for my very first convention in Las Vegas. And I was like, here, let me just sign. You know, she's like, well, what are you going to charge me to sign? I was like, you drove all that way. I'm not going to charge you to sign your books. You bought the book. I'll sign it. Just here, take a picture with me, you know. And I had a picture that I took with her, and it just never lost on me how amazing the fans are. The fans have been so good to me. And I mean, every book I've put out, I've put out 6 books. Every book that they put out, that I put out, has gone like ridiculous amounts. I mean, I had trouble scrounging up one of each, save for two. I've sold out of these other two that I could show during our interview here, but the other ones are sold out. I can't ever keep them in, so I've kind of given up.
Okay.
I'll take orders, you know, and then it's like, hey, you know, next time I do a run, I'll make sure you get one.
Yeah. Well, let me know, because I've been meaning to get one as well, so I have to let me know when they're available.
Well, sure thing. I mean, I've got three that are available now, two of which we've talked about, one of which is one we haven't discussed yet,
okay.
But we will. I'm sure we'll get to it. But whenever you're ready to see those, I'll definitely show them on screen for your viewers. You know, they can see, you know, so that's fine.
Okay, that sounds great. So I'm curious, what are some of your favorite topics to write about?
Definitely survival, especially in horror. I mean, it's kind of a hit or miss thing. Who survives, who doesn't. Mm-hmm. There's actually one book that I wrote called Whispers in the Woods that was put out in 2022 that it ends with an ending where you're so, you know, just like, whoa, because it's not like anything else I've ever done. It's a lot darker. Okay. So that book is more of a Appalachian ghost story gone totally wrong. Basic premise of that is there are a group of friends that are graduating high school, about to make that journey into college, one step closer towards adulthood and, you know, permanence and responsibility. And they find out one of their classmates has gone missing in the woods around their neighborhood, which for years has had a weird association with people going missing near or in them. And they decide to go investigate, and they get more than they bargained for, but they also, in a strange twist, get the answer to one of the world's most mysterious questions. What happened to the Roanoke colonists?
Oh, okay.
Who came to America to settle. Mm-hmm. So I definitely, that one was a lot shorter. That one was just under 80 pages. That's definitely a more short book. Most of mine are in between 160 up to 250, 260 pages. So I kind of hang out in that area. But I knew that because this one was going to be shorter and a lot different, it kind of felt like I had more freedom to kind of, you know, write it the way I wanted. Mm-hmm. As far as subject matter and characters and, you know, it was a lot of fun. But that's one of my favorite things to write about is survival. Also, one of my favorite things to write about is what I would call the psychopathy, you know, and how it affects the human mind. So like with a serial killer, like someone like Fred Krueger, you know, what happened in their life to perpetuate what they do later on. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not an excuse. There's no excuse to hurt anyone. But what, it's that age-old question of nature versus nurture. What in that home environment influenced certain decisions that they made as a person, as a character, mm-hmm. you know, in this particular set of books? And for him, it was abandonment, you know, abandoned by his mother. And, you know, abused by a stepfather. And, you know, then it was a whirlwind from there, straight downhill. Mm-hmm. And I like to see how that focuses on, you know, how their mind develops as a character. Because oftentimes the way I write the characters, the way they feel is completely normal to them.
Right.
But it's not normal to anyone else. But because it's a sense of normalcy to them, that's their routine. That's their normal. That's what they know. And I think that's what makes it a little bit more horrifying. You know, it's a lot more horrifying to find out your neighbor is, a serial killer than it is to read about some serial killer that's been in the news for decades that they haven't been able to bring in yet. And they're still finding bodies, but to find out that your next door neighbor, you might have gone to a cookout or gone bowling with that person. Mm-hmm. You might have invited them over for a drink. You might have went out and saw a movie together or whatever, double dated or something, and then you find out that they do all this stuff. And I think that's what makes it a little bit more horrifying. As far as Fathom goes, the big story with that was the realization of one's dreams. You have a cryptozoologist that wants to go to Loch Ness and kind of do his own investigation on things. He's kind of written the premier book on the subject, but he wants to go back and kind of experience it on his own leisurely time. And he gets employed to go and be a part of an expedition to do just that. Now, things don't turn out great, obviously, because it's a horror novel, but there are things that he is able to accomplish. That he's able to see up close, things that he never thought he could see, and making relationships that he never thought he would make. So there's still a focus on something positive in there, for him as a character. And with The Within, you have the main character has got a family that's fallen apart. His parents are at odds with each other over his father's job. There's threatening divorce. How does that affect a child? How does that affect someone? So it's all rooted in very real things for the most part. And I think that's some of the scariest stuff out there, the stuff that could just happen.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when it comes to villains, because horror villains that are evil for evil's sake just aren't interesting. But if you give them that backstory and that little bit of humanity, it definitely roots it in realism, but also makes it scarier, in my opinion.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, because while I do love some of the silent type killers that are out there, certain slashers and such, Freddy has got a personality. He toys with you before you die. He relishes in that. And I think that's what makes him, you love him, but you hate him at the same time. He is the perfect, anti-hero, for lack of a better word, but he's a character. When you go to those movies, you like the other characters, but everyone knows why you're really there.
Mm-hmm.
You're there to see Freddy.
Right. I'm a big fan of the Child's Play franchise, so I feel it's very similar with Chucky. Just he does such bad things, but you can't help but, I don't want to say root for him, but you like it. You like the character.
You do, and you find yourself feeling some sort of sad when he gets dispatched, but you find comfort in the fact that he always comes back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of both sides of the same coin there.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I know we talked a lot about A Nightmare on Elm Street and how, important that film series is to you. So I was just curious kind of how you got involved with writing books based on that franchise.
I really liked the story. I really liked the characters. I definitely felt like I could relate to a lot of those characters. And it's one of those films that sort of had its fingers on the pulse of what America needed at the time, what the world needed, because Freddy became an international phenomenon. And I think that what makes him so something that I wanted to have a hand in is, through each of the different films, you get this slight backstory on him in different installments, but you don't get a big, cohesive, fully fleshed out, explained, detailed understanding of what he did, why he did it, what happened to him after. It's kind of, it's addressed in certain installments of the film, but I really wanted to flesh out the original murders because, we all know what happened after he died, what he did, who he killed, what his plan was. But before he passed, while he was still alive and still human, that's something that was a bit more shrouded in mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wanted to bring that part to life and focus on things trying to hold down relationships, trying to keep a job while having this, as he calls it, special interest area, in the evening, working during the day at the boiler, at the Springwood Boiler and Maintenance Plant, and then at night, jumping into his ice cream van, in the evenings and going through the neighborhood selling ice cream to children, but also picking out victims out of those children.
Mm-hmm.
And, snatching away their innocence because his was snatched away. It's sort of his revenge was to take away from these children everything he could never have. He could never have a loving home. He could never have a family. He could never have a sense of stability, a sense of safety, security. And his way of getting his ultimate revenge was to rob Springwood of theirs. And he wasn't going to have a future. He died. Mm-hmm. But he could certainly take their future from them too. Because even while he was alive, he was very much aware that he was going to have no future. He knew he was on the road to nowhere, that it wasn't going to end well for him. And while it did surprise him in some aspect, I think as a character, he always knew that that's how it would be. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, picking victims in an area like that, an area where you live, you know, in a small town. Springwood is a small town. I mean, compared to a lot of towns, very small. And everyone got a chance to kind of really get to know everyone else on a more intimate scale. And I think that him failing at doing that, failing at escaping, made for enthralling storytelling. And obviously, I mean, it's just my interpretation, mm-hmm. but just fleshing out that backstory was important to me, kind of making him, bringing him full circle, making him more of a well-rounded character. Because, I mean, I've had fans tell me, I can read your book and go right into the first nightmare and feel like I've missed absolutely nothing. As a matter of fact, to go into the film more feeling like I have a better understanding mm-hmm. of his motivation as a character and what caused the nightmare to begin, you know? Mm-hmm. So, which I take as a very, very high compliment, the ultimate of compliments.
Oh, yeah. They should make a prequel movie that covers your story.
I've had some people do that. You know, I offer to do that and want to make it into a film, but you know, it's just not in the cards, and you know, yeah. with the rights and you know all that stuff. It just I don't.
Oh
know.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's very very flattering for sure. I've had several filmmakers approach me over the past 4.5 years trying to make half of my books into something. Mm-hmm. The last one approached me about trying to make The Within into a. I said if I do The Within, that's not going to be a movie. That'll be like a series because there's so much covered, and when oftentimes a higher budget television gives you more room to do your effects. I'm a big fan of the old school practical effects. A lot of my good friends are professional effects artists. My wife is a effects artist.
Oh, awesome.
So yeah, she practices on me sometimes. I sent a few pictures out to, some folks so they could get a look at it, you know, and that's not every day that you get to text somebody in a picture like that. It looked like I got into a bar fight, you know, and it's fun. I love makeup and I love effects and I love storytelling and film. And I think that's another reason why, I gravitated towards film, you know, as, you know, composing, producing, and occasionally acting. I mean, I've acted in probably about a dozen films and done some voiceover work and stuff. But I always like that medium because I feel like there's a way that you can tell a story with that you don't have to confine like you do a book.
Right.
You have a bigger, wider range that you can kind of pull into yourself, you know, pull in and use for doing something like that, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any writing inspirations, like other authors you look up to?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, I went through and read most of his works. He was a big influence. Dean Koontz, R.L. Stein. I was a child of the 90s. So mm-hmm. I did have Goosebumps and Fear Street, you know, lining the shelves. Stephen King, Bret Easton Ellis, oddly enough, who wrote American Psycho. He is one that I really, really liked. Mm-hmm. I really liked a lot of the different, because even though they're all doing something with horror, they all stylize it in their own way. So you're getting horror, that horror fix that you need, but you're getting it through the eyes of these different writers who have different nuances, different styles, different dialogue interpretations of how things could be done. And as far as like the horror community is concerned, I mean, definitely the ones I just named, R.L. Stein, Dean Koontz, Edgar Allan Poe was sort of the preeminent. He was the original in my opinion, the original R.L. Stine or Stephen King of his time.
Oh, definitely.
You know, with things like The Murders in the Rue Morgue and, you know, The Telltale Heart and The Fall of the House of Usher, which has been made into a series on Netflix. So, and again, you know, there's just all this stuff that continues to be made off of these incredible books that shows that they stand the test of time, because Poe died in 1849. And these books and things are still being adapted into films and series, and they're just as popular today as they were then, if not more so. So his legacy has lived on and continued. And I think that same can be said for Stephen King and for Dean Koontz and R.L. Stine. To leave a legacy like that, to have something that you can leave behind for people that love your work, something that was you know, like this was him, this was them. And that's just really something that I really, really enjoyed, is just seeing everybody's different takes on this universal genre that is horror, because it transcends genres and everywhere. I mean, it's international. Horror is loved all over, all abroad, right? Mm-hmm. You know, from the United States to, you know, all over the world and everywhere in between. I mean, horror is something that is universally loved. So, you know, I think that speaks a lot about it as a genre.
Yeah, definitely. I'm so happy you said R.L. Stine, because I grew up with Goosebumps, and it's like one of my favorite franchises of all time. I actually want to show you, probably can't see behind me, one second. So I bought this but painted it because it looked absolutely horrendous, but I have the Haunted Mask from the Haunted Mask episode.
Oh, I'll never forget poorly Carly Beth Carter.
Carly Beth. Yeah,
she was rough.
but I painted this. I bought it on Amazon. If you can buy this mask on Amazon. The colors look absolutely nothing like it, so I just painted it. But it's my
I love your paint job. What kind of materials did you use to paint that with?
It's really just acrylic, and then I just sealed it with the gloss, so the paint doesn't come off. So it's just
you did just a fantastic job. It looks great. Acrylic.
Thank you. And then I just cut out, because this was sealed, so then I just cut the mouth and stuff like that. So
can I ask you a question about the mask? And
what's up?
You know, I'm gonna ask, did you put it on?
Oh yeah, I actually went to a Comic-Con as Carly Beth, technically. And then I also, this isn't as good, but I'll still share it with you. I made the head as well, from the show.
Carly Beth Caldwell. Yeah, the paper mache head or whatever. Yeah,
so
you are definitely a Goosebumps fan.
Oh my god, yeah.
I love that.
It's one of my favorite like franchises of all time. So I'm super happy that you mentioned R.L. Stine.
You have such cool stuff. I want to show off some cool stuff.
Man, oh, you definitely.
That's awesome.
You definitely can.
Well, I don't have anything Haunted Mask related, but I do have a prosthetic stunt mask that was used on the original Nightmare on Elm Street that the stuntman wore to double.
Oh, that's
rock.
Awesome. Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's disgusting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Still has all the teeth and everything, the burns. So the actor that wore this, his name was Tony Caesar. He was Robert's stunt double. So they had a scene in the cellar where Nancy gets into a fight with him and douses him in gasoline and then sets him ablaze, and he tries to run up the stairs, and she hits him with the door, and he tumbles back down. Well, Tony got lit on fire head to toe and burned for 47 seconds straight before they put him out. Longest unseen burn in an independent film.
Really?
He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam before he was a stuntman. So he had another job while filming the original Nightmare. So I wish that I would have had that kind of resume. So he would work during the day on the set of the Ghostbusters inside the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man suit. And then at night, he would go film as Freddy. So,
oh my god,
what a job. What a
yeah,
job.
Seriously, that's so cool. Well, now that we're kind of showing off some things, do you want to show the books that you mentioned?
Sure, yeah, I can do that. Well, I've got a couple here. So obviously this is The Within, so that is the Possession novel.
Yeah, I love that cover.
Yes, Helsing did an amazing job. He's done almost every one of my covers. All of my fiction covers he's done. So then I have the very, very famous and universally loved Razor's Edge. He did
that's
that
the one
as well. Is that the one?
Yeah, that's
you like
one.
That one? And then he did the cover for Bad Dreams, which is a direct sequel to Razor's Edge, and he also did the back cover as well.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, he did a fantastic job. This book is the nonfiction one I was telling you about. So I did this book with the production designer from Nightmare 4, Mick Strong. So this one's called Behind the Screams. And basically what it is it's a making of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, but it has like over 10,000 photos in it.
Wow.
Stuff of how they did the cockroach face rip sequence, stuff that has never been seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to kind of show all that stuff off. And I have one of the original scripts that was used on set. And so they photocopied the script pages, which I have here with the sweater and the chain.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, this is a piece of history right here.
Yeah, definitely.
So they photocopied several of the pages. So that way, as they broke down the scenes in the book, you could see the script pages in there. And the first chapter was actually done by Robert Englund.
Really?
So he got to show off some really cool stuff of him. That's him and Bill Forsh. So Bill Forsh actually is the one that sent me the script and the sweater piece and everything. He was Robert's makeup artist on several scenes, and then he made up the stuntman in that film to look like Freddy as well. So.
Yeah. Did you say you know Robert Englund?
I do, yes. Robert and I have done a few cons, and I've been writing to him and talking to him and doing shows with him for years. I've known him since 1996. I wrote him letters as a kid.
Wow.
And when I got into the business, I've done some shows with him. And he actually, believe it or not, I've got a screen-used glove back here that he signed. This is actually a paper. This is one of the houses from 1993 that was made for that new Freddy film I was telling you about, Blake's Crazy Nightmare. But this is actually a glove that he wore in the films and is signed by him and the rest of the cast. And that's, you can tell, so cool. That is the real deal.
Yeah, that's actually dangerous.
Oh, very. And I have several of these. I have 8 of them actually here in my office, but I don't typically take them out. I usually only take out a couple. So for the new film, where they've got a new Freddy, they actually talked to me. The guy that built the gloves is named Josh Clark. He has a company called Flaming Creations, and he and I got together and built this one.
Mm-hmm.
So my contribution was I wanted chunks taken out of the blade and for the back plate to look really, really wicked looking.
Mm-hmm.
So
that looks
that's
great.
Actually been worn by the new Freddy. And yes, I've tried them on there.
Freddy has like the coolest weapon out of like all
Doesn't
the killers.
He,
like,
Doesn't
yes,
he? I really love
absolutely.
It. I love the weapons, but I've got a bunch of different ones. I've got a Freddy's Dead glove signed by Tom Arnold, who was in the movie with Roseanne.
Yeah.
I've got a bunch of Nightmare on Elm Street stuff, but yeah, those are my favorites for sure. You know, I love the gloves. I love the weapons. I think it's a cool weapon. And his makeup design was really cool. So, you know, I love the character just in general. It influenced a lot of my music work because I love the scores of the original Nightmare on Elm Street and like some of the other films from the 80s, like Silver Bullet. Jay Chataway's music for Silver Bullet was amazing. And of course, Danny Elfman, even though it wasn't horror, but the original Batman film from 89 that he did.
Oh,
I loved
yeah.
the music to that. So, when I sent you some of the scores, actually, that I sent, a lot of those are influenced by those same films. So the horror thing has kind of influenced just about everything I do as far as career, you know, is concerned.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about your music, actually. So you kind of told me, you kind of told me before we met up to record that you did everything in the song yourself. So how did you get into music?
My biological father was a professional musician, and growing up, I always heard all these incredible stories about his playing. He was a guitar player, and he actually got to record with some of the preeminent country acts of the time. Like he's played, you know, little things and little sets and stuff for Chet Atkins. He's played, you know, other stuff like that. So he had a long and kind of arduous history in the music business, and so did my grandfather. And it kind of just, you know, always was something that I wanted to learn, was just how to play music. And when I realized that guitar was what my father played, I decided to kind of follow in his footsteps and pick up guitar. Now, what inspired me to play, oddly enough, was a really strange mix. So I grew up in a really strange musical environment. So I would listen to stuff like Van Halen and Journey, but then on the same day you'd hear me listen to Alice in Chains and Nirvana and like Dawkins, Skid Row. So I'm definitely kind of influenced by a lot of the grunge, hair metal, 80s metal, and like, you know, arena rock stuff. So that's sort of what inspired me to sit down and learn. So I taught myself how to play guitar. I'm trained on my own. I trained myself how to play. And then after I learned, I took a year of classical guitar in theory when I was in college, just to further my understanding. So from the time I was 13, when I started playing up until now, I'm 38 years old now, I learned to play guitar, banjo, bass, keyboard, piano, drums, to sing and to arrange string sections, namely violin and stand-up bass and, you know, cellos and stuff like that. So I'm and I can play the ukulele and the dulcimer as well. So,
oh wow, that's awesome. Yeah,
it's a lot. So in the song specifically, I don't know which one you're referring to specifically. I know you have a favorite, it seems, that you have a favorite that you really like.
I like them all, to be quite honest, but the first one that I mentioned, I forget the name. Was it Lucid?
The really heavy one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one, I play rhythm guitar, electric guitar, bass. I arrange the string section. I play some keyboards in that. I don't do any vocals because that was meant to be an instrumental piece. They actually used it's in my portfolio to go into a film that's coming out in 2025. So I did put it out on the last record that I released, but it's still going to end up being used in that film. And I think that it's very anthematic. It has that quality because when I toured alongside people like Killswitch Engage and like Parkway Drive and Asking Alexandria, Black Dahlia Murder, Whitechapel and Muir. So that sort of style of metal, hardcore, metalcore, deathcore, that kind of genre kind of stayed with me. And I did that professionally for about 6 years. And then I retired from the business and became a composer full time. So that's how I ended up keeping those influences.
Yeah, I could definitely hear those. I used to go to Warped Tour back in the day. I had my own. It was a high school band, but we a heavy metal band for a little bit. So I definitely could hear those influences in that song.
That's wicked. You got any music I can listen to? I'd love to hear some.
I don't know if we have anything saved because that was 14, 15 years ago at this point.
I gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, outside of the music for our podcast, I don't make too much music anymore, but I do our music for the podcast.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. I've that's still new territory for me. I've done three or four episodes of a podcast, and then I did a commercial for a new brand of moonshine that was released called Smoky Mountain Squatch Shine. So it's a Sasquatch-based moonshine whiskey, and I got together and sat down and did the jingle and composed the music for that. But I've only done three or four episodes of a podcast. All Things Unexplained is the name of the one I do. It focuses on cryptozoology and UFOs, unexplained aerial phenomena, Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, you know, that kind of thing. And I've done three or four episodes where they used a continuous score that I did for them called Monsters in the Woods. But I like it, and I'm hoping to branch out here soon and actually maybe start, you know, looking at doing that full time and composing music for podcasts as like one of my other jobs, because I really enjoy seeing how the podcasts take what I've done, make it their own for their shows, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious what your process is when you write songs.
My process. That process has pretty much stayed consistent for me my entire life. So I hear a melody in my head. I'm a very melodic person. I used to get a little bit of trouble from the guys in the band because they were like, write something straight up heavy, you know, and I would. And they'd be like, dude, it's so amazing. But then I would turn around to the next song and write something super melodic. And they'd be like, dude, really? Can't you just do more of the heavy stuff? I'm like, there's a time and place. I was like, how many records do you want to sell? Because I've got to tell you this, if you sell the records and you've got a lead single that's super melodic, but the friends that go see you at the show that are into the melodic stuff bring their other friends that are into the heavy stuff, they're going to get a little bit of both. But if you just put something straight out heavy, where's the appeal? I mean, there needs to be a hook. you know, and I think that hook is important.
Oh, absolutely. You have to have those peaks and valleys and different tonality throughout the songs.
Absolutely. So like usually when I compose on a on an acoustic guitar. I have an acoustic guitar, a Fender CD-140SE. It's an acoustic electric. And that's what usually most of my songs, they kind of start life on that. I've got it right here, actually. That's my...
That's a beautiful guitar.
Oh, I appreciate that. But so like... well, like one of the ones I sent you, Find My Way. I know I sent you that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I was like in my head, I heard, I'll find my way. And I was like, what key do I want it to be in? So I got to fooling around on the neck and I was like, C sounds good. Let's try a D. And then how about an E minor? So then I kind of put them all together and I sat one night late. I drank some caffeine. It was late working my vampire hours, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, you know, I sat there and I was like, I'll find my way, make this life of mine. And I was like, I love that hook. That hook is wicked. So then I just ran with it. And the whole song fleshed itself out in about 15, 20 minutes. And then I spent another probably 30 getting it mixed down, getting the vocals done, because I did a split mic on the vocals where it would go through the left ear and the right ear, but at the same time, I didn't do a middle track for the vocals because the music was in the middle and on the side, so left and right. I wanted the vocals to come in stereo, so I did them left and right, and I didn't put them in the middle. And that's the same kind of process that I did for Lucid, which I mean, Lucid was just, again, it started out on this guitar and I had the guitar tuned like to drop D.
Yep.
Just a really low drop D sound. And I was just like, and I was like, okay, wicked. You know, so I sat down and kind of fleshed that out. And then an hour later, I had Lucid. And, you know, I was like, okay, so I'll just do a whole bunch of you. I just said, okay, let's just do a whole album. You know, so I put out a whole album and it's all different kind of stuff. So there's some acoustic stuff, which you've heard. There's some hard metal, hardcore stuff. And then there's some like pop punk kind of stuff because I love that genre, you know, too. That was a big genre growing up for me. And when I was touring, I toured a lot with pop punk bands. I did a show once where I did it was my band. And then I believe Bowling for Soup was on the card.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, that is the weirdest mashup of bands ever, because this venue would do. Okay. So say they had Allman Brothers Band, and then the same night they would have like Simple Plan. I'm like,
right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So my dad can come and hang out for Marshall Tucker or Allman Brothers, and then I and my friends can go hang out for Simple Plan. Word, you know, right. Okay, cool. So yeah. I like it. I kind of like the mix of the cards, but it was just so usual. There was another venue in from the city that I'm from. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee originally. And it was like they had, oh goodness. It was somebody like Blink-182 style, but then the next night at the same club, they had Rick Springfield. I'm like,
I've been to shows where like one act is like just someone on a ukulele just singing themselves, and then the next band right after them is like screamo and there's like mosh pits, so it's just the complete whiplash of styles.
I love it.
So do you find that you write more for movies and stuff, or do you write more for like just your own albums and stuff like that?
It's a fair mix. I mean, I've gotten to do a lot of stuff for movies and shows, but I find on the downtime that I do have when it comes to music, I like to record music for me. And I mean, the album hasn't come out yet, but I have another album coming out actually where it's funny, the place that you and I kind of met and connected was on TikTok, of all places. And I have a lot of my new music and a lot of stuff I've been doing on there. Like I'll upload little videos, which I haven't been really consistent on there lately because of the shooting schedule with the film and everything else. I've been kind of just busy. But I mean, I really liked, you know, getting to get on there and find out that there's an audience of people that like all kinds of different music. And, you know, I just put the videos out and videos, they're doing well. I mean, and they're really popular, and I've gained a lot of followers. I'm hoping to keep that trend up, and I'm hoping that I can start broadcasting some TikTok live from some of the conventions I do. I've got several conventions coming up this year, which, I mean, I can't really talk about which ones I'm doing just yet, but I've got my year is full of those. I mean, I'll do sometimes 8 to 10 is on the low end of things, and then sometimes it's with in-store signings and other stuff, it could be 20 to 30 a year.
Wow.
You know,
that's a lot of traveling.
It is. It's a lot of traveling.
Yeah. Do you like traveling that much?
I do like traveling, but I mean, I do miss being at home. But I love meeting the fans, and I love getting to hear about these incredible stories. Like, you know, well, when I first learned about your books, I was doing this or I was doing that, and that inspired me to you know, pick up a pencil and write myself, or, you know, I wanted to check out some of the horror stuff because I really wasn't into that before, but someone recommended your books, and on a whim, I decided to go get one. It's little happenstance moments like that that really keep you grounded, and you really find that a book really still has a lot of power. I mean, we are very much audio visual, you know, society, you know, with all the videos and everything going on, but books are still so very important, and they still means a lot to, they still mean a lot to a lot of people. So
yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask you this question. It's going to probably be hard, but if you had to pick, you could only do one for the rest of your life, would it be writing books or doing the music?
That's not a fair question.
I know. I had to throw it in there because I see you're so passionate about both.
I thought we were friends. What's the deal, right?
We are. I just like to throw a little hard question in there once in a while.
Well, you know, I already did the music thing professionally, and I already got, I mean, it opened a lot of doors for me, and I had a good career with it. So if I had to really pick, I'd probably just do the books. But I mean, because there's so many other ideas that I have rolling around in my head that I really want to put to paper, you know, and get out there. But I mean, more and more of the film and TV work is coming along. I mean, last year I was contracted to do two short films within a month or two of each other. And then I had the commercial, and then I had the podcast, and then I had this new film, this fan film, Blake's Crazy Nightmare. I'm doing a lot of the music for that. That's basically one of the stipulations in the contract was the company wanted me to score the film. They're like, we want you to be in it and play a version of yourself, but we want you, because we know your music and how it resonates with people and your history with playing, we want you to use your versatility and play a bunch of different styles of things. So we want some of the hard rock, we want some of the metal, but we want some ambient stuff, some creepy stuff, some soundscapes, some stuff that really gets people uneasy, you know, to kind of set them up for certain shots and stuff. So I said, okay, so that's one of the things is I'm doing probably about a dozen songs and musical pieces for that film, which is the most I've ever done for one film. And then the same company had me do two other short films I scored. And actually they had me executive produce on that. And then I was for a time executive producer on a bunch of other projects. And that's something that I've gotten into doing as an executive producer. That's new for me, but it's like getting funding, obtaining funding for films, putting the word out, doing social media campaigns, doing these book tours and talking about the other things and bringing in, you know, people you know, encouraging them to be a part to stay with and, you know, in the loop on what we're doing. So, and getting to make creative decisions is something that, I mean, when you're in a band, it's kind of like everybody has a vote on what we're going to put out as a single or whatnot. But when it's just me, musically, and I play all the instruments, I don't have to have that discussion with three other people or four other people. I have that discussion with me, and then I have that discussion with the film company or the company in question I'm scoring for, and we meet in the middle on that, and they tell us, hey, this is what we want. So I really like that artistic freedom, and what you heard, like Save Me Tonight, that acoustic song, would not have been something as big of a hit as it has been the past year. That would never have seen the light of day if I was still playing only metal. None of those songs would, like, the only songs that you heard that would have made it would have been Horizons and Lucid. Everything else they would have written off as too light, or they would have just thrown it in the trash. They'd be like, nah, you can release that on your own. We don't need it, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But you seem to be really appreciative of all the music in general. That's why I was really, really excited to be able to send you some, because you seem like me, like you kind of like a whole lot of different things and you have moods. Mm-hmm. You know, you might be in the mood for metal one day, and then the other day you might be in the mood for something acoustic. You might be rocking Killswitch one day and the Goo Goo Dolls the next day. You just seem like you're that kind
of
guy.
Oh yeah, definitely. I listen to anything from like the Lord of the Rings soundtrack to like one of my favorite metal bands is We Came As Romans. So if you listen to my playlist, it just goes all over the place, from like synth heavy pop stuff to sad acoustic stuff. So I like all genres of music, really.
I appreciate that. I think it certainly speaks to, you know, you're very well rounded when it comes to like what you like. And like you said, I mean, if you like it, you're not going to be like, oh, I'm not going to tell anybody that I like that. I mean, you don't care. You're going to be out and say, hey, I like this song. If you don't like it, whatever. I didn't ask you. You know, it seems like that kind, yeah. That kind of a thing, which it's so weird, because I think where it got me, like that moment where telling people about things I've done. So I was in a film, and the film was called He Comes to Kill. And for this film, I had to play a real scumbag, okay? Mm-hmm. I had to do some horrible, horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a young lady that was chained up in front of me, and I had to hit things and scare her and make her cry. And it was just, well, it was kind of rough. I mean, even for me. And then when I tell people that and they go see the movie, because it's streaming on YouTube and stuff, and it's on DVD and Blu-ray, they go see it and they're like, wow, I never would have thought you had that in you, man. I'm like, well, now, wait a minute. You have to understand.
It's not me.
I was told to, I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing I did besides music, was acting. That is the nature of our work.
Mm-hmm.
You read the script, you're told that the character is to be portrayed a certain way. And of course, you bring your own flavor to that. But, you know, there was improv, and it was, like I said, if you haven't seen it,
what's the name of this film again? I'm sorry.
It's called He Comes to Kill.
That's right. You said that. He Comes to Kill. I'm going to have to check this out, because now I'm very curious.
Yeah, it's well, I'll just put it to you this down. Way. I'm in like the first 10 minutes of it, but it'll be 10 minutes you'll never forget for the rest of your life.
All right. I'll have to check that out.
but the new film that I'm in, so the company I'm working for now, doing films for, they're called Dark House Entertainment, which I'm sure you've seen, like on that poster, you've seen the logo. They're very much they have their fingers on the pulse of what's hot in cinema as far as horror goes. Like, they're very versatile. They don't mind doing found footage, but they also don't mind psychological creature stories, you know, things like that. They're very, very well-rounded. And the director and founder of the company, David Brandon, is just an incredible character to work with. He has a vision, and like, he lets me have like free rein on things. Like, there are certain scenes in the script where I got to improvise all of my dialogue. I didn't have anything written on a page for me to look at. And he would take multiple takes, and we would look over them together, and we would both decide which we like best. And that's not something I'm used to doing. I'm used to things being done one way.
Mm-hmm,
but
yeah.
He's very, very versatile. So, I mean, I did The Sacrifice for Dark House Entertainment. That was one I co-starred in. It's a short film. That's on YouTube as well. And then there's one called The Treat, where I scored and produced that. I wasn't actually in that one. But they're both found footage, dark, kind of backlit, very very much in the same vein of the kind of horror you like. There's some whodunit elements kind of, you know, going on there. But I love working for them, and I've done so many projects, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm doing so many for them, and they've been very good to me. They make sure that when I'm in town, I'm taken care of. I never have to worry about anything. You know, my travel is covered. My everything is covered. My food is covered. I don't have to do anything that I don't want to do. And if I want to stay longer, like say I'm working on a scene and we look at it and decide, well, you know, I kind of want to take that scene again. He'll look at the clock and say, well, do you want to go for it tonight while you're still in wardrobe, or do you want to, you know, come at it from a different angle the next day, or how do you want to do it? I said, no, let's do it now. And I mean, we filmed some things on this film up until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Ooh, yeah, long day.
So long day. I mean, and I've done 8 to 12 hour days before. So it's not something I'm a stranger to, but I really enjoy checking out, you know, all the ideas that Dark House has. And I recommend, if you're not following them on Facebook, certainly give them a follow, because there's all this cool stuff. Like, there's so much in the works. They've already got 2 other full length films scripted already. Casting decisions have been made. Locations have already been scouted. They are on the ball with this, and I'm loving it because it makes my job easier. They tell me, well, we're going to go shoot at this location. And the cool thing about this Blake's Crazy Nightmare, this fan film we're doing, I got to pick out a lot of the locations on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want it to look authentic, and I want it to be, some of the scenes may very well be done in my own home.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah,
say for sure or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an option on the table.
Yeah.
So I feel like I get a lot of freedom and creativity, and I love working for Dark House and seeing what new things they're going to bring out to the table, because he was an entertainer and a musician a lot like me. I see a lot of myself in him.
Mm-hmm.
And just very visionary, and he's not one to let an idea sit and just be forgotten. He writes everything down. So, I mean, I think that's admirable, because there are things I don't bother writing down. I'm like,
yep.
No, but he does. So I have a lot of respect for him for that. And it's just, I love working for the company, and I love, you know, just being involved with it and getting to not only produce, but also compose, getting to act. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just I feel like it kind of lets me do a little bit of everything I'm good at. So,
yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned Blake's Crazy Nightmare a few times. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk a little bit about what even that is?
Sure. So Blake's Crazy Nightmare was a film conceived by David Brandon and Dark House Entertainment that sort of explores the idea of bringing back a darker Freddy, something more akin to the first Freddy, Nightmare on Elm Street, second one. Definitely a strong emphasis on the second one in terms of makeup.
Mm-hmm.
David is a big fan of practical effects, as I see you are as well. I mean, we love masks and makeup and real special effects. And so he told me right up front, that's his vision. And the story, what I can say about it is I'm a writer that's written some very well-received books on Elm Street, and I've contributed to documentaries and films, and I'm sort of one of the go-to people in the industry. As far as somebody with the knowledge on the characters in the universe, and I'm supposed to be working on a book, you know, a sequel book. You know, it puts me in a really dark place to do this stuff. And, you know, I've got a book publisher yelling at me on the phone, telling me that they need drafts in by this date, and we need this, and what's the story with that? And I feel like I'm constantly getting interrupted. I'm not sleeping. I'm you know, staying up at all hours of the night, and then it just becomes like Freddy has some sort of a control over me, because it's like he basically kind of threatens me in a way that if I don't get this book done and tell the story the way it needs to be told, everyone around me is going to suffer, and he's going to make sure of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts me in a very precarious position, because Freddy doesn't have a boundary.
No.
Not the way he's being played, and especially not the way he's being played in this. He's dark. He has no qualms physically abusing me. He has no qualms with destroying things. He has no qualms with making sure that I am this close to having a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's dark, and it's a return to a darker Freddy. There's not going to be really much humor. What humor there is probably going to be more gallows humor, as they called it, more like he was in the first and second films. And mm-hmm. the film just focuses on that interaction with me and how it's going to affect me and the people around me. So a good portion of it is still along the lines of psychological horror.
Yeah.
But there is a trailer for it on, like a teaser on YouTube. It should still be on there. If not, I may see if Dark House will send that to you, but it should be on it should be on YouTube still. I've actually taken a little bit of a break, and I haven't been working on the film stuff as much the past week or two because of, we got snowed in here, something fierce. We got almost 9 inches of snow, and I haven't had that much snow here in almost 14 years.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was a lot of snow.
Where are you located?
I'm Tennessee.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah. And they got a lot of snow.
Yeah, I'm in Cleveland, so like 9 inches is like, typical Tuesday.
I want to go to Cleveland. I had a bunch of fans ask me if I would attend a convention as a guest that was happening in near Cleveland, but now I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember the name of it. Do you go to any conventions out there? Like, do you know of a few that are out there doing doing shows?
Nothing horror related, but like outside of like Comic-Con and stuff, I can't recall anything off the top of my head.
Oh, that's okay, no problem. I just it occurred to me to ask because I can't for the life of me remember what the name of the convention was. I mean, I get requests to do so many. Are you on Facebook right now?
I'm not, but I can be in 1 second.
Okay, if you check your messenger, I actually found the teaser trailer for you, so you can watch that. Yeah, it's just a couple of minutes long. I actually had a debut for it at a convention I did in Arkansas. My first convention in Arkansas, I did a premiere of the trailer, and that was amazing. I got to do it with, you know, so many awesome people. Like, it was a packed house, and John Dugan was there, and it was like, this is why I do this, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it really felt like, you know. I was in good company, and you know, it's a lot of fun to get to like have that opportunity. So I highly recommend anybody, if you want to follow those dreams and write, put yourself out there, do it, you know. Get out there, write you a book, write you a song. You know, get on the shows, be relentless, don't give in. And I have a little piece of advice, which I mean, it take it how you like, but I always try to offer something positive. Granted, you know, my past has been a bit turbulent as far as how I grew up, but you know, own your past, know it's there, don't forget it, but don't let it take over your future. You know, let it stay where it is. It's the past. Don't forget it. It makes you humble to things. It centers you. It brings you back to reality. When getting out of, you know, days of signing things or days of filming, you sit back and you think, well, you know, that was a time that I never thought any of this would be possible. And I was stuck in a really dark place, you know, and I never forgot it, but I didn't let it become who I was. So that's a piece of advice I always try to offer, is move forward, you know. Don't forget your past, own it, but don't let it define your future. Be you and be your authentic self, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great advice, especially for anyone doing any sort of creative work. Well, really anyone in general, but especially for like creative projects.
Absolutely. I mean, it just, life's too short. There's too much negativity as it is, and this is my way, even though it's, and I always say this, the horror community is one of those communities where you're like, you don't realize how close-knit and awesome and warm people are in a community like that till you get to really know them. I've met more friends and made more lifelong friends, business contacts, and friendships and professional relationships that have lasted years now. And I'm, you know, it's people I worked with at horror conventions, you know, and people, there's like, I think still a little bit of like, wow, a horror convention, because it's like people don't know what to expect, but, and they think it might be scary or, you know, something like that. But it really is a really warm, giving, authentic, genuine community, and it's one I'm proud to be a part of. So if you haven't gone to a horror convention, I highly recommend it. Just go check it out. You know, no pressure from anybody there. Just go have a good time, and you'll see people dressing in cosplay in these amazing outfits, and you know, you'll see vendors there, you know, and selling neat stuff, and you'll see all your favorite actors, writers, artists, musicians, you know, whoever you want to see. And I mean, I've done some amazing shows, and it's not something I ever thought I would be able to do. I mean, you don't think that kind of stuff is going to happen to you, because you kind of get in that habit of sometimes where it's like you question your worth on things. But I mean, it really hit home for me when I got inducted into the Hall of Horror in 2016 in Las Vegas with Lon Chaney's family. I got to stand up there and accept a plaque for my books and get my hands shaken and get pictures taken and have the Chaney family respect me and have a good time. That's, I grew up watching them. I mean, do you realize what the inner monster kid in me was doing at that moment? Like, I was running in circles. Like, I was like, there's no way this could happen to me. But I mean, I still get to, you know, look at this every day awesome. And I go, this actually happened. And if it can happen for me, then it can happen for anybody.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's so cool.
Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate you letting me come on the show and have fun. I'm glad I made a new friend, and, you know, we
hang
out, and hopefully we'll get to meet in person sometime. Maybe I'll get up into your area, you know, one of these cons, or maybe a signing. I mean, people seem learning. See if there's a, you know, can we call a comic store and see if he'll do a signing? I'm like, you can call him. I don't know if they're going to have rooms for me with my fiction books at a comic store, but yeah. I'd be more than willing to make the trek, you know, whatever it takes to keep the fans happy, because there's still so many places I haven't been. I've been all over the U.S., but there's certain states and places that I haven't been able to be in, and I'd like to make my mark and get to say I went there, you know. I'd like to go to Cleveland. I want to go there's a big horror community following in Portland, Oregon. Apparently there's cons popping up there, and I was like, wow, I've never been to Oregon, you know, let's go.
Yeah, you know, that'd be awesome.
I want to travel and meet the fans all over and, you know, make memories. And I'm really thankful. So, you know, even, you know, you checked out my stuff. I thank you for taking time out of your day to check out and see something special in what I'm doing and for having me on the show. It's been a delight. And, you know, I love doing this kind of thing. So I appreciate the opportunity very much.
Oh, of course. Thank you for spending some time. I know we're already over that hour, so thank you for doing that.
I figured we would be.
Yeah, for sure. So thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up here?
Certainly. Definitely go hit me up on Facebook. I know you have the links to my author page. I'm getting close. Facebook is yelling at me because I'm at almost 5,000 friends. I wish that thing would be a little more flexible, but it's not in my control. So if you can't find me on my personal page, certainly go, you know, follow and like my author page. I am on there pretty regularly. There's always stuff being posted. I just posted an announcement the other day that I finished editing a book for another author. So that's something I've done different this year. I actually edited the second book in the Zoe RN universe, written by Alexandria Christensen. And I'm going to tell you, that book was an absolute delight to read. It was fun. There were scary things in it. It was very well told. And I felt like I could get lost in the story. And it became less like work and more like fun to me to sit and just read this and edit it for her. So, you know, that's something new that I've done. This is I've become an editor for other books. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Yes, everyone definitely go follow Blake on TikTok for one, because that's how we met, but all of your other social media accounts, and be sure to check out all your books, your music, and anything else you're doing.
Well, I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing everybody, and thank you for having me. It was really, really a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. I would like to thank Blake again for spending time with me. Be sure to follow Blake on social media and check out all of his books and music. This has been Terror Talks with 13 Degrees of Screams.